Welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Dominic Cavendish. With me are Daniel Evans and Emma Fielding, who are starring together at the RSC this summer. In Measure for Measure, Daniel Evans plays Angelo to Emma Fielding's Isabella. In Cymbeline, she is Imogen, and he, her husband, Posthumus. Each relationship is in itself a highly intriguing one, and arguably stands at the heart of the drama in question. Although there are only three major scenes in which Isabella stands face to face with Angelo in Measure for Measure, it's her insistence on remaining chaste, coupled with her appeals for clemency on behalf of her doomed brother, Claudio, that worked a crucially disruptive effect on him, stirring his desire and bringing him into conflict with the moral fundamentalism he has introduced in the Duke of Vienna's absence. Likewise, there are only a handful of scenes in Cymbeline in which Imogen and Posthumus are together, but their enforced separation and the vengeful jealousy that snares him subsequently when he takes Iachimo's brags of sexual conquest at face value dominates a major part of the action. Daniel Evans and Emma Fielding, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. The first question I wanted to ask was about this pairing, which is very intriguing, these two plays together and you two in two couple relationships together. I wondered how much there was a decision at the beginning of the season to put you in both plays. Was it simply fortuitous?
Well, I don't know. My understanding is it was just a happy accident. We'd worked together before, but we hadn't actually spoken to each other on stage, I don't think, had we?
No. Well, I suppose we had, because Emma and I were here 9 years ago at the RSC in my first, both our first seasons, yeah. And we did a play on the fringe when we played lovers then.
Yeah. You were a Native American and I was a tardy old actress. No change there. Yeah. But the other thing was Adrian Lebel's Midsummer Night's Dream that we were in together, but I was one of the lovers and Daniel, you were in Flute initially and then you were Lysander, but we never spoke to each other on stage. But I think knowing each other with both these roles really, if you have any kind of shorthand with someone, it saves time in rehearsal. But it's been fascinating to see that similarities, actually.
Yeah.
And of the obvious differences, but the similarities have been more striking for me.
Yeah, and we rehearsed the two productions in such different ways. And therefore it was kind of, our processes were completely different, weren't they? And,
yeah.
So in that way there isn't a similarity, but, of course by the second play, there is a shorthand and there is a physical, you know, ease and a rhythmic knowledge that you have of each other as well.
Yeah.
I assume that perhaps you would have rehearsed Measure for Measure first and that would have been in some way beneficial to Cymbeline, given that you're apart so much of the time in that play and that you've got to make that relationship light up very fast. Is that the case?
Well, there's only one scene at the very beginning and not a very long one at that.
No.
And then they're off their separate ways. And they don't actually exchange too much dialogue at the final scene either, do they? Is any that why did you throw your wedded lady? Well, apart from when you punched me out, then why did you throw your wedded lady from?
Yeah. And even though you know that something that we found in the rehearsing for Cymbeline, quite late on actually, was something that Dominic Cook, the director, had really wanted to impress upon us in the play, was that these two young people at the beginning of the play were absolutist, and you know so much hyperbole is used, and it's you know that their vision of love or their idea of love is of a romantic ideal, and that during the play what happens is that they're tested, and their idea of love at the end of the play is very different. So that was something that was that it is slightly Romeo and Juliet-esque.
As you said, the language in the first scene is extraordinary, and the language that she uses in, I think it's scene three, when she's talking about how she would have, you know, I would have broke mine eye strings, cracked them, but to look upon him to the diminution of space, appointed him as sharp as my needle. I mean, all this language is really extreme. And not unheartfelt, but I think what I like about what Dominic's done at the very end of the play is that there's an echo of what happens at the beginning with the exchange of a ring and a bracelet, but it's done in absolute silence. They've been through a bloody war, and it feels more adult and they don't need that language anymore because they have a deep understanding and a deep, they found a deep truth together.
Mm.
Because of the terrible things they've been through.
Mm.
They've both been tested beyond any relationship is normally tested.
Yeah.
Beyond the limits that any relationship is normally tested.
Mm. I suppose the tragedy of, for me, as Angela, then going back to Measure for Measure, the, one of the tragedies is that there, I think it's a match made in heaven. But because he, well, because of circumstance and because what happens to him after he's given a bit of power is that he can't somehow just ask her out to dinner. That he, you know, he doesn't quite know how to be, and so
he's not good with girls, is he?
No. It's all boys for that.
All boys, yeah.
Talking about emotional absolutism, that very obviously applies to Measure for Measure too. They're both highly rational, intellectually driven characters, aren't they, Angelo and Isabella?
But and also linking in with the whole language question, the way they that Angelo and Isabella use each other's language, they completely get inside each other's heads in those two big scenes where she goes to plead with him for Claudio. It's extraordinary. They are complete intellectual equals, and that's what, that's sort of his downfall in a way.
I think that's right. I think that's what gets him, is her brilliance, her intellectual brilliance. That is what makes him be an absolute lust for her.
That, I mean, they are. I think they're made for each other as well.
Yeah.
Because morally, that they occupy completely the same area. Their faith is at their very centre, and that there's a deep understanding. They have a shorthand. And they play with language together. And her problem is that she trusts him completely. There's no question in her mind that they're having anything other than a rational discussion. And she thinks he's testing her by asking her, if, you know, would she hypothetically sleep with someone to save her brother? And for her, of course, it's not an option at all.
Emma Fielding, how do you handle the transition of that extraordinary scene, Act 2, Scene 2, where the... Where the more persuasive Isabella is in arguing this compassionate case, the more she undermines her own position, because at some point what she's saying registers in Angelo's mind. Did you find it easy to register the shifts that were going on beneath the rhetoric?
Well, I was quite aware, particularly in that second scene, when there is an obvious shift.
Yes.
But if she goes into that room and picks up on it immediately, it makes a lot of the dialogue redundant. So, for a modern audience, perhaps she seems rather stupid or rather naive, not intellectually but emotionally, to not pick up on what he's hinting at. But then she hasn't been privy to the soliloquies. The audience obviously are privy to that.
Yes.
So I had to make a decision that it's not until it plainly conceive I love you that it even begins. Were you a woman? Be that you are a woman. That's such
then,
a shock. But even then, she said, no, you're still testing me. I know you actually have the license and you're still testing me. And it's not to believe me on my own honour. My words express my purpose.
Mm.
And A, she can't believe how stupid she's been. She's shocked. She feels betrayed because she's completely trusted this man. So I've had some students say to me, isn't she a bit thick? Not to realise. But that's... She's had a very sheltered life. And in the way that Imogen is tested, she is tested. Her faith is tested. Because at the beginning, she wants to be St. Bernadette. She wants to be the best nun. And her faith's never been tested in the secular world that she occupies. So that was, that in terms of decision-making, that was something I had to think about.
And to speak about the first scene, if someone read the play and they didn't know anything about it at all for the first time, the first inclination that you know what is going on inside Angelo is his aside. She speaks, and 'tis such sense that my sense breeds with it. Up until then, what we see is an argument between them, and then he shuts up and lets her talk.
Mm.
And she's coming up with this brilliant argument about how it's, you know, how one has to be very careful with power and how easy it is to misuse it and to be tyrannous. And that's when he's completely silent, having got battled with her, and he finds that he cannot match her argument. She's beat him intellectually. And then he asks her, why are you saying these, why do you put these sayings upon me? And she comes right back, because authority, and again beats him. And then he turns to the audience and then says, my God, she is so brilliant that I'm actually turned on.
They're very extreme characters. One of the differences with Cymbeline is that the action dictates a lot of the experiences the lovers undergo. Posthumus and Imogen are tested, whereas here there's a sense that there's something in these characters that provokes conflict and change. You mentioned the idea of Isabella not cottoning on fast enough, and behind that there's the question, isn't there, of her position itself being unpalatable. The idea of more than our brother is our chastity.
I was brought up a Catholic, and so notions of faith and a faith that gives you quite strict rules to live by is not completely alien to me. And I see it as something quite benign. And we were lucky enough to go and visit the nuns at Tyburn, which is a closed Benedictine order. And also Shireen, who plays...
Juliet.
Knew someone whose auntie was a nun and put that question to them, you know, would you do this to save your brother? And she's like, absolutely not, I'd say some prayers. And that's now. But actually, in the context of the play, because it's such a patriarchal world, and for women, there are very few choices. Maid, widow, wife, prostitute, nun. That's it. And all women are seen as whores. And the bargains that are presented to Isabella by the Duke and Angelo are to do with her being sexualised. If she sleeps with Angelo, she not only completely compromises her faith, and if you have, which I don't, a deeply held belief in eternal damnation and purgatory, there is no way that you would even contemplate that. But also, you're espousing a really huge abuse of power. And it's not just... The other thing that and in terms of language, what I keep saying in rehearsals is, it's not just, oh, just shag him, just sleep with him. It's, would you agree to be raped by this man? It's a rape at the heart of it. And it's a complete abuse of power. It shows corruption at the highest political level. So on both counts, and she's completely aware of that, the notions of power. So on both counts, I'm surprised at how much I understand her unwillingness to compromise.
So portraying Isabella for you doesn't entail suggesting the possibility of a struggle then?
I think her struggle comes after she's seen Claudio, because until that point, she thinks that he will completely espouse her. They've been brought up together in the same household. You know, he has such a mind of honour that had he 20 heads to tender down on 20 bloody blocks, he'd yield them up before his sister should her body stoop to such abhorred pollution. So she knows if she just asks her brother, he'll say, don't do it. And he does that. But then when faced with the reality of death, and he has that wonderful speech, you know, to die and go, we know not where, that is when she's at her most tested. So the hardest lines for her aren't more than our brother is our chastity, because at that point she's reached a resolution and she has clarity. It's after that point when the Duke says, well, how are you going to please Angelo and save your brother? And she says, I'm now going to resolve him. I had rather my brother die by the law than that my son should be unlawfully born. And I think that's really hard for her to say, because she's been tested at that point and she has to reaffirm her faith for herself. But she, of course, she's a human being. She's not frigid. I don't think she's afraid of sex. She loves her brother. That's why she leaves the convent. Otherwise, she'd just stay in and say a few prayers, but she doesn't. She leaves. But that's when the reality of the secular world and the way she's been tested really hit home. And it has to be a struggle for her. She's not a machine. So what I've tried to do is present her moment by moment to the audience, and hopefully at the end they'll understand. They might not agree, but the whole play is muddied. People are making decisions they should never have to make, because of the world, because of the upheaval after the war. Economically, everything's fucked. So she should never be asked to make that decision. And so we just lay it open for the audience to go away and be provoked, hopefully.
The conceit, you alluded to it there, was placing it in a post-war, war-ravaged Vienna. I wondered how useful that was in determining your own approach to the characters.
I always feel ambiguous about placing things so sharply and directly into a period, although I have to say, with Measure for Measure, I feel like it really helps. We watched, the first thing we did in rehearsals was watch The Third Man, Orson Welles' film, and that has very much been the basis of the influence for the production, which is a post-war city where all kinds of social and moral codes are being broken, breaking down, and that there is a crisis, that especially in our city, sexual mores are being everything's going crazy. So there is need for a big, for zero tolerance, for a Giuliani type. Also it is. I think it's far back enough for us to remember, or within our recent history, but not so recent as to be after the 60s, or it's pre 60s and pre any kind of sexual revolution. And so I think both those points are very helpful.
And they explain the extremity of moral positions that people adopt, the kind of fundamentalism they arrive at.
Well, indeed, as some people choose to go, that the way of Pompey, which is to become a bawd, to become a pimp, or to become a prostitute, so people choose to become nuns and pious people.
Mm. Mm. But it is, in the writing, it's a secular world, and we've set it in a secular world. It's not, and what struck me is that Shakespeare doesn't make any. He doesn't really judge Isabella. I think he feels slightly sorry for her, but he's playing for mercy and tolerance, and not to abuse power. And it's very, his humanity is extraordinary, and his ambivalence about the Duke is wonderful, because I don't think it's a happy ending, and we don't present it as everything being tied up neatly, because the play is lots of shades of grey. It's not black and white, and that's why it's seen as a, I don't know if someone said this to you, but at the beginning of the season they said, "Oh, you're brave." I was like, "Why?" She says, "Oh, you're doing two problem plays in one season." I don't see them as problem plays. I see them as some of the most exciting plays in the canon, because they're not Disney.
No.
You're stars of these two productions, and yet the centre of both plays is quite hard to discern. You might expect your characters to have, if anything, a larger scene count than they do. There's some criticism of these plays. There's a notion that they're problem plays. Did you feel you could create anything approaching a totally coherent vision of them, or that perhaps they were in some ways impossible, finally, to crack?
Well, a play will always be of its time, be that, the relatively arbitrary group of people who happen to work on it. And for me, what's been very rewarding about both productions is that, I gather that I haven't, as I said to you earlier, that the reviews for Measure were mixed, but I think that's the nature of the play, because the play is hard. It's hard morally. It's the language is quite dense, and people have preconceived ideas. Like, I'm not wearing a habit, And people, there are two questions people ask, like, "Are you wearing a habit?" And "What are you going to do at the end with the Duke?" Everyone has preconceived ideas of what it should be. But I think with both productions, it was, everyone felt they could contribute, every single department, be it, the design, music. So what we tried to do is create something greater than the sum of its parts. And not to impose anything on the story, to expose the text, to sort of, and also to scrub off all that Victorian nonsense and the romanticism that has been slapped on both of these plays. Where Isabella is St Bernadette and Cymbeline, they're all skipping it through Wales and it's all a bit lovely. It's just, that's just dulled and dead to me. And we're not in a museum here. We're trying to interpret them as we find them, as a group of actors, directors and creative people. I think
it's impossible to be definitive in Shakespeare. Because I think it's too hard. It's too open, and that is why we can see these plays time and time again. Is that you see an individual actor's response to that particular part, and that is I agree with Emma that I think the idea that people have preconceived notions and prejudice when they come to the play, and maybe critics because they see so many versions of the play, that's hard to try and introduce them to my response to Angelo, for example, or whatever. But I will say also that in Cymbeline, which is I think structurally a very difficult play, and but Dominic Cook, the director, again had decided not to want to solve it, not to want to give a definitive production, but just to let the play be as it's written in all its complexity and weirdness and structural difficulty, actually. Something I've learnt while performing it and rehearsing it now is that it's really posthumous. It's such a hard part because you have these three great scenes where the deal is set up with Iachimo, and then I have this big break, and then I have four soliloquies one after another where I'm not sure, but sometimes when I'm playing it, I think, what was Shakespeare on when he was writing it? Where I have a dream and Jupiter comes down and I see my parents as ghosts, and was he just writing it very quickly and just to finish it, or is there something else structural that's happening that's more expressionist in a way? I'm not sure, but anyway, The point is that Dominic hasn't tried to solve it, hasn't tried to make it definitive, has just let it be.
The play is a relay race. That's what, well, ideally every play is, but you really do feel that you're part of this sort of football team.
Yeah.
You're passing the baton on, and you have to keep that momentum going, because it's long as well.
Yes, it is.
But you have to relish the storytelling, and everyone's a part of that, and everyone feels a connection to it, no matter how big or small their role, because of that process. I mean, with Cymbeline, again, I found it really hard to learn, and I thought I was losing my marbles, because usually a verse play, I mean, I don't have problems learning lines, and verse play, it just sort of goes in. But Cymbeline, and I spoke to, you had Anton Lesser and other people in the cast were saying, oh, God, this is hard to learn. And it's because he's really mucking about with the verse form. There's so many irregular lines in it. And it is like a jazz musician right at the end of his life, knowing all the rules and playing with them and breaking them. And that was really interesting, and also emotionally, if you follow the verse line, it really helps you with your interpretation. So all those things can be married together, they're not in isolation at all.
But I think it's true to say that the main point was, well, how do we make this complicated story as clear as possible, without simplifying it, and without making it a children's production? How do we tell the story as economically and as clearly and as excitingly as possible?
The physical challenge of doing both these plays, how have you found that? Is it strange going one night into one play and the next night into another?
I mean, with Cymbeline, I feel sort of like a red setter sort of running around. But Isabella is so closed off, because she has to be, and protective, and physically it's a completely different world. I mean, also you have to keep relatively fit and eat properly, otherwise you wouldn't be able to do them. But I love the contrast, and it's strange, I don't know, but looking at Daniel every night, when he changes so much when he becomes Angelo, it's almost like his face changes. And it's great. And then you meet Posthumus, and he's a completely different person. So that's been extraordinary.
I think Cymbeline is like a marathon, I have to be honest. At the end of, when we do two Cymbelines in a day, look at you at the end then. But we have this bit where we both come together to do the exchange, as Emma mentioned earlier, and when I look at you at that point at the end of the day, and I think, my God, I really feel like I've, run them.
And the first scene seems days ago.
Yeah, it does.
Months.
It does.
We've really all been literally and metaphorically on this huge journey of Cymbeline. as have the audience, because in that space, hopefully, the audience, there must come a point where they give in and leave their cynicism behind and go with the fable that it is. It's a fable. It's literally fabulous. Yeah. It's a fable. So, and by the end of it, there's this wonderful, really works, there's this wonderful complicity with the audience. There doesn't feel like there's a dividing line between the audience and the cast, and that's, I mean, ideally that's what you're trying to achieve with every play, but it's much harder in proscenium arch theatre, especially if you've got an orchestra pit, because there's literally a gulf between you. But it was, you know, if this play does have another life, either the plays have another life, unless you can find the right space for this particular production of Cymbeline, it'd be quite hard to recreate the intimacy that we have in this one.
Daniel Evans, Emma Fielding, thank you very much indeed.